Is there a silver lining to Brexit after all? The illusions and mythology surrounding Britain's place in the world might finally lie exposed, and the four nations of the United Kingdom are left to deal with the realities of interdependence in the globalised 21st century world. And forced to engage with these challenging facts, can the union of the four nations survive the coming whirlwind of change? So today we ask, is the final triumph of Brexit the end of Britain?
Together, we have changed the course of British history.
I want everybody to understand that the treaty that I've just signed is not the end. It is a new beginning.
I love to see people take their country back.
I think most people here are patriotic. They love our country, our traditions, our queen, our flag, our armed forces, our British way of life. They like all those things and they don't want to lose them.
Welcome to the Another Europe podcast with me, Luke Cooper, and my co-host, Zoe Williams. It's been 5 rocky years, but in a way, the Brexit story has only just begun. It's sometimes hard to step back and take it all in, appreciate the enormity of it all. But that's what we're going to try and do today. Find some real historical perspective. To make sense of it all, we're joined by historian David Edgerton, a professor at King's College London. David is the author of numerous books and articles, but the one we're really interested in today is The Rise and Fall of the British Nation, a 20th century history. We'll be breaking the historian's rulebook by asking him for his thoughts on what the future might hold for Britain after the EU. You can feed back to us on the show and feed in ideas on what you'd like us to cover in the future by emailing podcast@anothereurope.org.
Hi, this is Elena. Back in the 2016 referendum, I was just your regular politically active migrant. So I was so happy when I found Another Europe is possible. I grew up in Bulgaria and my opportunities to move to the UK 8 years ago to study and to change my life and to change my politics even basically came through membership of the European Union. So it's sad that we're now living through the Brexit that we warned about back then, but that's why we need to keep going, because none of the issues and none of the problems have gone away. So that's why I think you should join us today. Go to anothereurope.org and you can get access to an extended version of this podcast by making Another Europe is Possible your home too.
So, David, thanks for joining us. Let's start with your recent Guardian article. What did you mean when you said Brexit had the silver lining, that it could lead to a bonfire of national illusions?
Well, reality is beginning to hit, and we need a good dose of it. And we need to understand what the UK's real place in the world is. We need to understand that it's the 5th or 6th largest economy measured by GDP in the world. That doesn't put it amongst the great powers. It puts at the level of France or India, a combination of Spain and Australia. In other words, it's a big Canada rather than a small United States. And I think it's important because we need to appreciate that we are really much like many other nations in the world. Not something special anymore. I think the UK was something very different and really rather special around 1900. But today it's another European nation, but it's one that has suffered from these terrible delusions of grandeur. And I don't just mean the Brexiters. I think our whole political culture has been imbued with a notion of, let's call it global Britain, a term coined, I think, by Gordon Brown when he was prime minister. So these notions of a powerful Britain, a global Britain, as opposed to European Britain, have been immensely damaging. I don't just mean in the case of Brexit. I think they've stopped us looking at ourselves, stopped us doing the things that we could be doing to improve the lives of ordinary people.
And do you think it was easier to have that realisation in the 1950s and 60s that Britain was an increasingly post-imperial power when the empire was rising up against British rule? And was that part of Churchill's calculation, because of course Churchill is, as is pretty well known, certainly in Remainer circles, famously and perhaps sometimes surprisingly, was a very big supporter of European integration. And he saw European integration, it appeared, as something that European states had to do in this world in which their empires could no longer be relied upon to back them up, if you like, in the great game internationally. And so was it easier to have that appreciation when the empires were falling apart compared to in the 21st century, where somehow the illusions and delusions and myths of grandeur seem to be really powerful part of our politics today?
I think today we have genuine delusions of grandeur based on history. In Churchill's time, you only had to look back a very few years to remember a position where the UK and the British Empire really was a great power. It wasn't delusional. I'd say this about your very interesting point about Churchill and European integration. I think it's a mistake to see European integration as an alternative to empire, as something that followed on from the decay of empires. People like Churchill, and indeed the French, saw European integration as a way, actually, of supporting their own imperial projects, as well as supporting, if you like, the bigger project of exerting power in a world that was obviously dominated by the Soviet Union and the United States. There's a very strong tradition amongst Remainers, liberals in Britain, to see empire and European integration as antithetical. And I think that's profoundly mistaken. Now, it is the case that the UK applies for membership of the EEC in 1961, at the very moment when much of the empire is going. And at that stage, it's certainly seen as an alternative. Well, not an alternative to empire, because the empire doesn't exist as an alternative anymore. This is really, by this stage, the only way to go. But what's remarkable about that is that only 15 years after the Second World War, the Conservative Party, which was without question an imperialist party, shifts decisively to become the party of European integration, as opposed to the Labour Party, which officially was against entry into the EEC in the early 1960s.
I mean, in a way, though, is the reason Remainers started to conceive the EU as a kind of post-imperialist or anti-imperialist project because there was so much imperialist nostalgia in the Leave project? So it's almost that their historical misunderstanding determined ours. I mean, sorry, I'm saying ours as though we're all Remainers. And I wonder if that's true a bit more generally, that like every mistake the Brexiters have made has been kind of mirrored by a like-for-like mistake on the part of those opposing them.
Yes, that's a very interesting point. But I think Remainers have misread the Leavers. It's certainly the case that Remainers have claimed that Leavers were nostalgic for empire. That's been a tremendously important argument. But I think if you actually look at what the Leavers were saying, empire was not really there at all. I mean, for some of the Brexiter ideologues, something called Kanzuk was present, and for others, the slightly larger category of the Anglosphere. But that's not the same as the empire. That's the white dominions, plus, in the case of the Anglosphere, the United States. But I think that was a very much a kind of minority position amongst the Brexiteer ideologues. In terms of Leaver discussion, the emphasis was very much on taking back control, on hostility to immigration, hostility to some kind of notion of Brussels red tape, a global Britain. And it's basically a free trading position combined with a deeply nationalist rather than imperial focus. Now, one very particular problem we have in the UK is that imperialism and nationalism are conflated. In fact, imperialism is seen as a kind of characteristic expression of British nationalism. I just think that's wrong. I think British nationalism is to be distinguished from imperialism, essentially, and that Brexit has got much more to do with nationalism than imperialism.
Yeah, I strongly agree with both your final point and also the methodological point of analysing Brexit in terms of what did the Leave campaigns actually argue for, and is that is likely to yield the most revealing insights into what drove Brexit. And it was, you know, take back your money, borders and laws, that these were fundamentally claims about national sovereignty. The area where it becomes complicated is this tension, of course, which we're going to come on to talk about in a moment, actually, let's not jump ahead, but the tension between English sovereignty and British sovereignty, and the way that those were deliberately confused in some ways in the claims, or inevitably intermingled with one another. And then there's the further idea, insofar as this had a claim about empire, it was quite easy or quite frequent for the Leave campaign to present a kind of notion of Europe as an empire that we would find release from. So it was almost like this plucky little Britain, this plucky island trying to break free.
We believe that a nation like the United Kingdom will soon be able to gather her strength and, in close and amicable association with her friends, step out again into the world as a free, independent and sovereign partner to the other democracies.
This idea that Brexit was almost like a Reformation-like moment for Britain, freeing itself from Rome again as a great sort of trading nation going out into the world and forging a new sense of itself, rather than Britain as an imperialist power now in its own right.
Yes, absolutely. History was certainly important to a lot of the Brexiter imagery, but you're absolutely right to focus on the question of the Reformation. The Napoleonic Wars would be another one, and indeed the Second World War. I mean, all moments in which the UK disentangles itself from the continent of Europe. As you rightly say, the focus is on a trading, buccaneering Britain, not an imperial Britain. It's not about planting the flag or a civilizing mission or anything like that. It's about business and trade and ships. It's a global vision and an anti-European vision, and indeed a hostility to Europe as a collectivity. I mean, perhaps you suggest an empire. And it is the plucky little nation that is going out there to do its thing on its own that's central. Yes, you're quite right.
I mean, for all that Remainers got wrong about the worldview informing Brexit, I think it did pinpoint rightly that a lot of the project was based on illusions, delusions, myths, you know, notions about Britain and Englishness that were unfounded. You've also argued that Brexit in this light compares quite unfavourably to those big turning points we were just discussing. And furthermore, Labour had a very worked out plan in 1945 for a national economy. Thatcher's plan was very worked out. Do you think it's still true that Johnson and Cummings are sort of seat of pantsing it? Or is there content there which we just haven't yet divined?
I don't think there is serious content to the Brexiter programme. I don't see any evidence for it. And in a sense, there couldn't be serious content behind the Brexiter programme, because it would have involved understanding the very things the Brexiters want to deny. The most important point of which was that leaving the EU would make a difference. They wanted to maintain the fiction that everything would stay the same, except that we wouldn't be paying anything in and we'd be free to do trade deals with the rest of the world. But turns out that Brexit does mean Brexit. And it's very notable that they haven't prepared. Fishing is a spectacular case. I mean, fishing was and remains politically extremely significant. One would have thought that they would have worked out what the kind of deal that they actually wanted implied for fishing and prepared for it. But they simply didn't do that. And that argument extends, of course, right across British industry and British agriculture. They weren't able to mobilize businesses behind a Brexit program because they couldn't admit, even to businesses, even in private, what Brexit really entailed.
There is a catastrophist view that actually there is a programme, but the programme is so ugly that they won't say it out loud, that it's a programme to deregulate, take all the breaks off everything between corporations and workers, and turn us into something much more like America. But do you think that's overstating it?
No, I think that's exactly right. I think there is a programme in the sense that they want to take the country in a particular direction, and that is, yes, to make it look more like the United States, or at least their image of the United States, and that means deregulation, that means more open markets. They, however, haven't worked out what the relationship between that program and the reality of leaving the EU has been. But yes, that's clearly the direction they want to go in. That's the deep rationale for Brexit, it seems to me. And it was expressed, actually, in many, many speeches. Now, for example, Boris Johnson often spoke about cheap food, cheap clothes, and cheap shoes. And this would benefit the British poor. Now, what's behind that? Well, it's the idea that once you could import tariff-free from the rest of the world, all these things would indeed be cheaper. It's a classic Edwardian free trader argument. And of course, they do go on about, and from the beginning, gone on about a free trade. But they've had, as many people have pointed out, a very Edwardian notion of free trade as tariff-free trade. They've never really understood the issue of non-tariff barriers, of regulation. But here, they've developed a very particular fantasy, which not enough attention has been paid to, which is that the UK can be in a hub for deregulated innovation. So it can set standards for the world, particularly in high tech. And that indeed was central to the Cummings programme. But they were advertising the fact that it wasn't much picked up. Now, I think that's delusional as well, because the United States and China and the EU are in a position to enforce their own standards on much of the world, and the UK won't be able to do that. But there was at that level a plan for a post-Brexit UK, often wrongly called Singapore on Thames.
Yeah, I think you can read a lot of conservative policies now through this lens as a negotiation between what Brexiteers in SW1 and the British Parliament like think and believe, and what the electoral coalition they have built very successfully around Brexit thinks and believes. And the most recent example of that, of course, is the employment regulation. I think we've grown very used to conservative U-turns under this government. I think this one took 14 days in the last 24 hours as we're recording this podcast. They've announced the business department won't be undertaking a review into EU workers' employment regulations, having briefed the fact that they were undertaking this review to the Financial Times 2 weeks ago. A derogation on workers in employment rights is completely kryptonite to a lot of the working class, new working class voters that they picked up in the 2019 general election. So they really have engaged very successfully in, I guess, what Marxists like me would call hegemonic politics. They've managed to draw in this very wide ideological coalition around Brexit, really successfully using nationalism and national identity to build that coalition. But they're now stuck with, well, what do you actually do in office? And we can speculate, but presumably, although the issues aren't identical, the next U-turn will be over the universal credit uplift. Because again, I think the Resolution Foundation found that it would affect the new Conservative seats that they gained in 2019 twice as much as it would affect the traditional affluent Conservative seats. So there's a huge contrast in the demands now amongst their electoral coalition.
Yes, absolutely. I agree very strongly with that. I think they are, to some extent at least, being hoisted on their own nationalist petard. But I think it is important to recognise that they achieved an astonishing feat, which is to dress up and radicalised Thatcherite politics in a deeply nationalist bigger story. So you have this extraordinary situation where you have effectively a potential anti-London politics, anti-finance politics and anti-free trading politics and anti-globalist politics directed against Brussels and not against London. I mean, that's political genius to do that. Essentially, you had a radical Thatcherite programme which was supported by the very victims of that programme, the so-called Red Wall. But we shouldn't overdo the Red Wall aspect of the Brexit vote. That's part of the narrative of Leave itself. The great block of votes for Leave came from Conservative voters. And the dominant characteristic of Leave voters like Tory voters is that they're old. And I think what's really interesting there is that people voted Leave must have voted Remain in 1975. So it's not that people were stuck in an old way of looking at this issue. I mean, again, this points to the falsity of the imperialist argument. Our voters were hardly going to be less imperialist in 1975 than they supposedly are today.
The thing which cheered me up, if we're going to go back to kind of pre-Maastricht, is that, as you say, that change between 1950 and 1961 was quite dramatic. You know, we became much more Europhile in a relatively short time. Do you feel like that could happen again?
Oh, yes, I think so. And I think actually this time around, we'll have a more realistic understanding of, saying earlier, our place in the world, and that will strongly affect how we think about the rest of Europe and the EU in particular. Yes, I think things will change very, very quickly, actually. And it is important to recognise that the Leave vote and the Conservative vote are the votes of the old, and the young are somewhere else entirely. And I think there's a great danger in thinking about the politics of the UK in terms of the views of very particular sections of the retired population. I think our politics, like our television and our newspapers, revolve around grey audiences, but there's another nation out there that is very, very different.
They've gone quite quiet about it now, but there was once this Brexiter idea of universal free trade in which Britain would just have zero tariffs on everything, or goods rather. You point out this would make the trade deals Brexiters also wanted to sign completely pointless and or impossible. Can we talk about that contradiction?
Yes, indeed. The people proposing Brexit were nearly universally free traders, and they wanted to see the UK not just as a global champion of free trade, but as a nation that didn't have any import tariffs itself, as was the case before 1914. And there's an argument for that. That means you can buy cheaply from the rest of the world, whether it's food or manufacturers, and that might be a good thing as long as you can export something. But it's a very tricky thing to achieve in the modern world, because if you say to the rest of the world, actually, we believe in unilateral free trade, we are not going to have any import tariffs, the rest of the world will say, well, fantastic, we'll sell you more than we're already selling you. Thank you very much indeed. So they twigged, I mean, rather late in the day, that they would have to impose British tariffs in order to negotiate them away in free trade deals. So the tariffs that the UK is imposing are actually very similar, there are some differences, to the common external tariff of the EU. Now, those tariffs, of course, don't apply to the EU as a result of the trade deal. The tariffs don't apply to the countries which now have rolled over trade deals with the UK, but they would be useful in a negotiation with the United States. And I think the United States wants is no tariffs on food, that's what it wants to export, and no regulatory barriers to US food. And I think that's precisely what many of the Brexiters actually wanted from the beginning. But they learned that trade is something that countries wish to control. And if you want your goods to enter markets, you need to offer other countries concessions. So you need to build up barriers in order to negotiate them away.
And we now have this amusing quality of the current British debate that the free traders have suddenly become open protectionists in some ways. I mean, I don't think John Redwood, who is known since the 1980s as a passionate Thatcherite, would ever, until a few months ago, have imagined in his political career he would start talking about the virtues of import substitution and building stronger British manufacturing as a result of the new trade barriers that have gone up with the rest of Europe. So it has turned our politics on its head quite considerably.
Well, I don't know if our politics as a whole, I mean, certainly John Redwood's, yes. I think what's interesting is how little ground that protectionist strategy has made in these discussions, actually. We're still talking about being a champion of free trade and all of that stuff. And to the extent that Gove has said things like preparing the documents for export to the EU would make companies match fit for the global economy. These are ideas which are deeply, deeply, deeply held by these Brexiters.
What role do you think Thatcher's legacy played in the Brexit project? Because in a way, there's two Thatchers, isn't there? There's the famous video of her in the multi-flag jumper campaigning for membership of the common market in the 1975 referendum. And then there's also the Margaret Thatcher of 1988 and the Bruges speech, where she said, we're not having anything to do with this secretly, covertly socialist project of European supranational integration. And it's that second Margaret Thatcher that seems to have come to dominate the politics of the Conservative Party.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, it's not just the Margaret Thatcher of the referendum 1975, it's also the Margaret Thatcher of 1983. The Labour Party stood on a Brexiter ticket in that election. I mean, people forget that Brexit was the position of the British left, not of the British right.
It is that precious inheritance given us by the people who fought for the right to vote, fought for the right to form trade unions, fought for the right to establish their own institutions, fought for the right to have an elected House of Commons, which should be the supreme authority in this country and answerable to nobody else. It is those things that are at stake.
There was an extraordinary transformation in the late 80s and especially in the 1990s. And yes, Margaret Thatcher, actually not really of the Bruges speech, I mean, it's later, the anti-John Major Margaret Thatcher, that is a huge inspiration for the Brexiters. Furthermore, Brexit was a radical Thatcherite program. It is continuity Thatcherism. To be sure, there was a great Thatcherite project of the single market, but the Brexiters wanted to go further and to create an area of free trade much bigger than the EU, and indeed came to see the EU as a protectionist despite the single market and despite the reduction in its overall protectionist stance. And there's a third element as well, which is that the Brexiters have stood on a platform which says effectively that Thatcherism reversed the British decline, that the UK is really a very powerful and important nation, which has been transformed in the last 30, 40 years and can now be unshackled from the EU. Now, that's not an obvious Brexiter position to take. It would have been very, very easy to adopt a kind of declinist rather than a revivalist position to argue for Brexit. That's to say, we've been in the EU since the 1970s, look at the state of the country, we've got a massive trade deficit, we were told that we'd be able to sell into Europe, but actually the Europeans have been able to sell here and we haven't really done so well over there. That would have been a potentially very plausible story indeed. I mean, as it were, this was the story that the Labour left and briefly the Labour Party more generally were putting forward in the 1970s and the 1980s.
As a marker point of Thatcher's pro-Europeanism, she addressed the United States Congress, and it's a very interesting speech.
It's not been an easy passage to blend this conflux of nationalism, patriotism, sovereignty into a European community. Yet I think that our children and grandchildren may see this period, these birth pangs of a new Europe, more clearly than we do now.
She basically sees her role there as reassuring the American political elite that just because Britain was becoming very pro-European and pro-European single market, that meant that she was neglecting the special relationship. And it's a real sign of how quickly things changed in historical terms from there to, as you say, the mid-1990s.
Yes, absolutely. And it's crucial to remember that the US has always been in favour of not just European integration, but UK membership of the EC and then the EU. So there never was a contradiction.
But even as interesting as Thatcher is, I'm also interested to hear you talk about the Labour Party, because in your piece, you say there's a need for a genuine national reconstruction, which should aim to create a better country. What would the elements of that be, and what should an opposition be calling for?
Yes, I think realities have changed in lots of ways, and there is an opportunity to put forward a programme of national reconstruction. And I think the two key elements are democracy. A lot of the argument against the EU was around a democratic deficit, but of course the real democratic deficit was at home, not in Brussels. And the second closely related element is a new politics of equality. Over the last 40 years or so, we've seen massive increases in inequality. And I don't think you can have a national community with high inequality. I mean, a nation is created by a floor on wages, on benefits, on conditions, which is higher than not the whole of the rest of the world, but much of the rest of the world. Because if you're just taking part of a lower global floor, there's nothing much to distinguish you from people in other countries. That's to say, in a radically globalized world, the poor have much more in common with each other and the rich have much more in common with each other, you know, across national boundaries. If the notion of a nation is going to make any sense, there's got to be more equality than there is today. Now, of course, there are potential dangers, enormous potential dangers in a program of national reconstruction that we need to be very alert to. One of them is the emphasis on deluded high-tech investment. And we've seen that in Dominic Cummings, but there's a great risk that would become a bipartisan policy. And another area where the politics of national reconstruction would be very dangerous is in the field of armaments. And it's a very great temptation to say we need to invest more in high tech, of course, arms for the sake of national security and support our global mission. We need to encourage the exports of arms, not worry too much that the great majority go to foul dictatorships. So those are very important dangers. But I want to argue really that historically the Labour Party has been a party focused on the national, that has used the national as the basis of a critique of selfish private interests. So that the national has not been opposed to the global, the national has been opposed to private interests. And I think in that spirit, a programme of national reconstruction can be politically very effective and socially economically desirable as well.
So that's a really good way of putting it. And I also think the idea of greater equality is the thing that can unite a very broad coalition of people, a very broad coalition of voters from the socially conservative to the socially liberal. Like, the support for greater equality, as you've seen recently with Marcus Rashford's interventions around free school meals, seems to have this very powerful moral appeal in 2020 in perhaps a way it didn't a decade ago. But on the other hand, and I guess this is the next question, Britain is a multinational polity. And so how do you in 2020 deal with that contradiction? How has Scotland featured in the post-war project of Britain historically? And you've also argued that the end of the Union could be a very good thing. So is it possible for a project of national reconstruction to include Scotland, or are they just inevitably going to become two different projects of national reconstruction?
I think it is possible to have a United Kingdom-wide politics of national reconstruction, but we are a very, very long way from it. We do need to recognise that there were very important pro-independence tendencies before Brexit, but they have become much stronger as a result of Brexit. I mean, not simply because the views of the majority in Northern Ireland and Scotland were ignored by the Brexiters, but the way in which they've been ignored. I think it showed a singular kind of lack of understanding of the realities of the United Kingdom and the extent to which the United Kingdom was actually held together by membership of the EU. So we had an extraordinary return of very, very hardline unionism in the Conservative Party, our precious union. I mean, that's new language. But the party of that precious unit betrayed the Northern Ireland unionists in the most extraordinary way. I mean, politics in Westminster might have forgotten that, but that's obviously not going to be forgotten in Northern Ireland and probably not in Scotland either. So I do think the glue that was holding the United Kingdom together has loosened. So I think Scotland already has a politics of national reconstruction through the SNP. I mean, Ireland will have a different sort of politics. It's a politics of Irish unity and integration into the EU. So the question is, can there be a politics of national reconstruction for England? That's the big one. And I think, as many people have been arguing, and I'm rather late to this, there are important possibilities there. I'm very taken by Anthony Barnett's argument that the kind of Scottish equivalence of the Red Wall voted Remain, the issue is the democratic deficit in England and not Brussels. So there are possibilities there. And I'd go further actually and say that I think it would be a good thing for England if we saw united Ireland and independent Scotland. I think indeed that one of the reasons that Conservatives of all parties were so horrified at the prospect of Scottish independence in 2014 was that they fear that would lead to a radical diminution in their status as political leaders or potential political leaders, that they saw England as a massively reduced thing compared to the United Kingdom. But that is really why I think it would be a good thing for England. If it's like Brexit, a mechanism through which the elite begin to realize what the true nature of the nation is and how it compares with other nations, and we can begin to address our national problems. I think Rory Stewart had a very interesting observation about the House of Commons. One moment the debates are about topics more appropriate for a local council, and the next it's debates which should be happening in the United Nations. And there isn't anything like enough discussion about the debates over which the House of Commons and the British government actually has control and has responsibility for. And I think that's a very acute observation, not just about the nature of the House of Commons, but our politics as well.
I mean, that's a bit of a marmalade dropper, though, isn't it? That England would actually be better off as this kind of rump nation because it would have a reckoning. The flip side to that is that it will be without the progressive forces that Scotland kind of represents.
Yes, yes, yes. I mean, this language of rump is very interesting, rump UK. I mean, it wouldn't be, rump isn't the right word, is it? I mean, it would be 90% roughly of population and so on. So it would still be, still have roughly the same weight as France and India in the world.
But many of us would experience it as a really sad thing, as a kind of going backwards.
Back a few centuries, you mean?
Yeah, back to the...
Well, I think what Zoe is trying to say is, doesn't it just condemn us to conservative governments forever?
Absolutely. That's exactly what I took her to be saying in pretty plain terms, yes. Well, my answer to that is that I hope this national reckoning would change British politics. In the end, I don't think there's much hope for a progressive politics if we have to depend on Scottish progressive votes. There simply aren't enough of them. We need a new progressive politics in England. And that's a politics that has to be created. I think there's a great danger in thinking that COVID or Rashford's initiatives themselves show that there is a kind of natural, as it were, move towards a more egalitarian, more collectivist perspective. I don't think that's right. I think these things have to be argued for if they're going to be at all sustainable.
That concludes this episode for those listening on the podcast platforms. But the discussion isn't over. An extended version of this podcast is available to members of Another Europe Is Possible. In this week's Extra Time, we asked David for his thoughts on Ireland and Northern Ireland in the eye of the Brexit storm. It's a good chat. If you want to listen to it, just sign up to our people-powered movement. Another Europe is the home of the pro-European left. You can join at anotheureup.org/join, doesn't cost much at all, and makes a big difference. My frivolous question is, what is your historian's perspective on what England and Wales would be called when Scotland leaves? Would it still be Britain?
Yes, I don't think it could be Britain. It would be, I don't know, Greater Wessex or something like that. Maybe.
Yeah, because I read recently...
Or Great Wessex, I think that would be a better name.
Because apparently some of the Anglo-Saxon kings did declare themselves kings of Britain, even though they only ruled, I think it was Alfred, they'd only conquered the English kingdoms, but they just decided to call themselves kings of Britain anyway. So maybe we could just carry on being Britain without Scotland.
I think it'd be difficult. I mean, Britain is a complicated term because it's used not just for England, Wales and Scotland, but for the United Kingdom. And it's, in fact, it's remarkable the extent to which the United Kingdom has not been used until really quite recently as a term to describe the political unit in which we live. I mean, the United Kingdom was a term used by diplomats and perhaps the military and people who dealt with foreigners. It wasn't a term used in internal discussion.
So on the subject of Ireland and our final question and area of discussion, there is always the sporting contradiction at the Olympic Games where the UK team is referred to formally by the announcers as the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, but then wears T-shirts saying Team GB, immediately excluding, in some degree, arguably, the Northern Irish from the identification of the team. And if you think that Scotland raises complicated issues for the post-Brexit United Kingdom. Northern Ireland seems to take this to a completely different level. There's lots of talk of Irish unity after the recent poll giving 42% support for Irish unity against 47% for the union, so pretty close and reflecting those long-term changes in Northern Irish politics. What are our thoughts here? Is it the end of the road for the union in Northern Ireland too? And has that indeed already happened to some degree, given the nature of Britain's withdrawal agreement with the EU?
Oh yes, I think the border in the Irish Sea is of enormous importance. It does break the union in a very, very important way. And this is why, you know, Theresa May went to extraordinary lengths to avoid this. So yes, something hugely important has happened there. And inevitably, the economy of Northern Ireland will integrate more with the Republic of Ireland than it has in the past, and that will have political consequences. There's also important demographic movement. And people expect that the nationalist community, cultural Catholic community, will increase in size, relatively speaking. So it's not a foregone conclusion, of course. But something really, really important has changed, and that change and others make it much more likely that we'll see a united Ireland.
I find it all chilling.
You find it all chilling? I mean, my hypothesis in Northern Ireland is that at some point the Alliance Party, which has been doing quite well in elections recently, taking elements of the old unionist vote, they are often accused, not unreasonably, by Irish nationalists of being a quasi-unionist party because they're in favour of the status quo and to stop talking about the union. That's basically their position. So, of course, that does make you effectively unionist. But my hypothesis is that because they're also so strongly pro-European, they're basically Liberal Democrats, is that at a certain point it would make a lot of sense for them to actually start promoting Northern Irish independence as an alternative to Irish unity. And you could see the merits for that as a kind of compromise position that could appeal to some unionist voters. And also we know that European integration supercharges the sovereignty of small states. So the argument to have a position for Northern Ireland around the table of the European Council would actually be a very powerful one.
Yes, and I think that might well be an option that's very attractive to the Republic of Ireland as well. So yes, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, we shouldn't assume that a united Ireland is the only possible outcome of Northern Ireland leaving the UK, absolutely.
Why do you find it chilling, Zoe?
Well, I suppose because it's taking on that aura of inevitability. I mean, I certainly, you know, when Scotland voted no in 2015, I felt glad that we were still united as one kingdom and sad for them because I thought they had built up a powerful progressive argument and it hadn't got it over the line. There is a kind of element of mourning that whatever the consequences are for our reawakening as a progressive England, the reason the union is splitting apart is because of our appalling government. You know, it's not simply the actualization of long-held dreams on behalf of Northern Ireland and Scotland. It's genuine revulsion at Westminster and it kind of quite well-founded. So it is sad. I do, you know, I do feel sad to be the one still stuck with Westminster when everybody else peels off.
That's fair.
I suppose the way I put it, it's not just our appalling government that's at issue. It's a whole structure of government, the nature of the state, I mean, how our politics is organised. There's a revolt against that, and a kind of revolt against particular English ways of looking at the world. And one element of that would be the Scots, at least the Scottish nationalists, do want to compare themselves with Europeans, particularly, I guess, the Scandinavian countries. But the English political elite doesn't want to play that game at all. There's a very different set of reference points. And many and many of those are about, you know, a special British mission to the world, whether it's global free trade or an ethical foreign policy or, you know, fair play, or, you know, all sorts of things like this, which are deeply, deeply ingrained in the British political elite, the British cultural elite as well. And I think all that needs to change if the union is going to be held together. And it needs to change, I think, if we are going to reconcile ourselves to the necessary task of making this a better country.
Yeah, I agree. I think from a purely amusing perspective, the historical timeline, that all four constituent parts of the United Kingdom rejoin the European Union as independent entities is surely the most amusing from a political perspective. You know, in 2050, everyone's rejoined and it realises federalism, but in this European form, because the four nations would be part of this supranational larger structure. So bring it on in some ways, I say.
Yes, I think that's an appealing picture to paint, but thinking those kind of possibilities through are, I think, essential to a new politics.
Well, I seem to have fallen in with a load of separatists. I can't imagine how this happened.
Sorry, I'm agnostic, but I'm attracted to it from the sort of grand historical picture of it happening, I think would be quite incredible and could have some progressive outcomes politically too.
But you know. Here's another version of that argument, and that is that England becomes a colony of Gibraltar.